committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, Truth and Engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Immigration reform is an issue that just won't go away. And that's because despite all the hand-wringing and political orations about aliens swarming over our borders, we just don't seem willing or able to fix what almost everyone concerned calls our broken immigration system. Every once in a while, the conversation comes out of a lull due to a crisis, the latest of which was created by the hundreds of children, unaccompanied minors, who have crossed our southern border illegally to escape gang violence and probable death in various Central American countries. So this hour, we take another look at the system that allows newcomers into our country legally or otherwise, and we hear from two immigrants about their own experiences. One of those immigrants has told their story on this program before, but that was before they were deported, only to return after a period of time away from our shores. Diane Stewart is that immigrant. She came from South Africa with her husband and children and started a successful business here in Charlotte, but their work visas expired and they were asked to leave. They did, for Ireland. But now they're back, trying once again for permanent status in the United States. And Diane Stewart joins us for the hour. Welcome back.
Thank you for having us, Mike.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Elver Barrios, a community organizer affiliated with the Latin American Coalition, who also immigrated to the United States as a child from Guatemala in 2005. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Jess George is executive director of the Latin American Coalition, which is North Carolina's largest immigration rights organization. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Greg Weeks is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
Well, Diane, let me start with you. We're going to hear two immigrant stories this morning, and then we'll also hear from Greg and Jess. Let's revisit your story, because when we start talking about immigration, a lot of people say, well, these people need to come through channels. If they just obey our laws and come through channels, there would be no problem. You've been dealing with our channels now for how many years?
13.
13 years. Which proves that going through channels can be very difficult. You did come here through channels on a work visa from South Africa. The visa had a sunset date on it. I'm encapsulating your story here. It had a sunset date on it. You tried to get it extended. You tried to go through every hoop in the known world, the legal hoop. Nothing worked, and you had to leave. Tell us why you came here in the first place from South Africa.
Well, primarily to open up a business for my husband's company. We came here to expand his business. He's already very successful business in South Africa, and he had a lot of opportunities available to him here in the United States, and that is why we decided to relocate here.
And you came here with a business that did business with our government, and in fact it was a business, if I recall correctly, that was deemed by our government to be essential to our government. What type of work was it?
We have a highly specialized reading and intelligence advancement program that we present to military organizations in this country. We present it to business schools. We present it to universities, students, and businessmen.
So it was deemed essential by our government, and yet at some point the Immigration Service said, well, we don't care what the other branches say, you're out. Is that essentially, in a nutshell, what happened?
Well, yes, it was a technical issue with the application that we made for our green cards the first time. The first time was a disastrous attorney who turned out not to be an attorney and, in fact, a criminal. We then redid the entire process and reapplied the second time, both of us individually. Both of us were turned down. And ironically, the reason for it being turned down has since, in the last 6 months, been rescinded by the USCIS. So, in fact, they've gone back on their own decision, which is very frustrating and a huge waste of money for us.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, if we had to appeal that, which we didn't have time to, if we'd gone to the Supreme Court and appealed that original decision, we probably would have won.
So the last time you were here, it was just months away from you having to either have a successful intervention with the government or you had to leave, and it turns out that you had to leave.
Yes, we ran out of time, essentially.
So yeah. When you run out of time, after you've been here for a period of time doing essential work for the government, and you run out of time, You have to go.
You have no option. You have to do what Mitt Romney calls self-deportation. Nobody told me I had to go. I voluntarily shut down my business, packed up my home, stopped my life here, left my daughter here as an F1 student in college by herself, and left the country not knowing if I could ever come back.
So why did you do it? Many people wouldn't. Many people would just stick around. Why did you leave?
Well, because I intrinsically believe in the rule of law, and I intrinsically believe that this country can get it right if it wants to.
So when you left, where did you go?
Well, fortunately for us, we have all have Irish passports through ancestral registrations in South Africa. We all have Irish ancestors, grandfathers, etc. And so luckily enough, we had those passports available to us, which was in fact quite a miracle because my son's South African passport had expired.
But
so we couldn't. So he wouldn't be able to.
But isn't he a South African citizen?
Yes, but his South African passport had expired, and it normally takes about a year to renew a passport in Africa.
So we ran out of time.
So
if you couldn't have gone to Africa, what would have happened to him?
Well, he wouldn't have been able to come back here, and he wouldn't have been able to get into the country without a passport.
So, how long do you when you're asked to leave because your visa has expired? How long do you have to be gone before you can come back?
Well, that was an open-ended question. I didn't want to leave the country unless I knew that I could actually come back, and I had a way of coming back. And my attorney said to us that he could bring us back on yet another, a different work visa. Unfortunately, that particular work visa that he had in mind, after 2 weeks of sitting in Dublin, he then informs us that the 65,000 cap on that particular visa, which is an H-1B visa, a skilled worker visa, had been reached.
You mean the 65? Not only 65,000 people can come in?
Exactly. And it reached that cap in 2 weeks after being announced.
Okay.
So you have a window of about 2 weeks now once those visas are taken up every year. And I missed it.
Okay.
So we were at a complete loss of what the next stage would be.
I mean, given of all the rigmarole that you've had to go through, all the money you spent, all the hair pulling that must have gone on, and the seemingly nonsensical hoops that one has to jump through, why did you want to come back?
You know, somebody asked me that the other day, and they said, "Why have you put up with this for so long? You must really love this country." And in fact, I do. I do love this country, and that's why I've come back.
You returned in September 2012, if I'm correct about this, on what is called an O visa. That's an extraordinary ability visa. Once again, the government recognizing the necessary nature of the business that you provide. That visa, however, expires on August 2nd, 2015. So you have about a year and a month to go. Not even a month, a year to go. And you had to wait a year to once you got here to apply for permanent residency, something I believe you had done before. You did that on August 24th of last year. So where does that stand?
Well, the short answer to that is I have no idea, and neither does our attorney. We are at the mercy of the USCIS as when they get around to processing our paperwork.
I don't know if there's anybody on the panel other than Diane who can talk about this, but that sounds crazy to me. Is that the way it's done all the time? Historically, is that the way we've handled immigration?
Mike, and that is why I have deemed it to be an inhumane system. Is because it ruins people's lives, it ruins them financially, and it is a heinous system that only when you've walked it and lived it like we have do you realize how utterly broken it is.
Why would it be that? I know this is partly politics, partly bureaucracy, but Greg Weeks, you're a professor of political science. Why would a country that's fairly logical, based on the rule of law, why would we have a system that is so illogical? I don't even know what the word to use. Byzantine.
It's just poor planning. So
after 200 and some years of a nation built on immigration, it's poor planning?
Unfortunately, yes. So what we have are immigration laws that are passed, and obviously politics has to play into laws, but political events and desires at the time play into how the laws are written. And then the laws are written in ways that are impossible to enforce.
And laws get written all the time. But when was the bulk of our immigration law written? Does anybody know?
Yes, I think.
Yeah, several. Well, there's several different times. The early 50s 1965 and 1986.
And what was going on politically at that time? Were things more favorable toward immigration in those years than they are today, or have they morphed over that time since the 1950s?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of efforts to deport Mexicans in particular in the 1950s, but I think overall the general perception was more positive. We actually had a guest worker program at the time, the Bracero program, which didn't end until the 60s, and then immigration law came after that, so that it has morphed. Even in 1986, with the Immigration Reform and Control Act, it was bipartisan. Ronald Reagan signed it, said it was great, and that era now is completely gone.
One of the other things that is troublesome, I guess, even if you want people not to come here, people have come here and they brought with them children or they have started families here, and that raises the question of what to do with the children of these people, some of whom, because they were born here, are American citizens. So if you're going to deport their parents and you're a 7-year-old American citizen, what do you do with the child? Send them to a country whose language they do not speak, whose experience they've never had? What do you do with them if you deport their parents? You have children. How old were your children, Diane, when you first came here?
6 and 11.
So they've pretty much been raised in this country.
They are intrinsically and culturally entirely Americanized. And I just want to go back to a comment that that you made earlier about the fact that the reason why we have this immigration system is that 95% of our laws that were written in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s focus on family reunification. So 95% of our immigrants that have come to this country in the last 50 years are family members. Only 5% right to this day are for economic reasons. And so people have come here, bringing their families here over all these years for jobs, for an economic reason. And in fact, that's a completely different picture to what the laws actually have been written for.
So, and I can speak to that, right? Like, you know, like you said, people come here because of their families, right? And I believe that that's the only reason people come here, whether it's for a better economic opportunity, because they want to have a better future for the families. And that's what happened to my family.
Yeah, that's your story.
Exactly. So in 1997, my dad decides to come to the United States and leave us behind. I was 6 years old, my older brother was 8, and my younger brother was 3. And the reason he did that was because there was no economic opportunity for us. There was no better future for
us. So you are from Guatemala. Your
exactly.
father came here by himself.
Exactly.
Left your mother, left the children to come here to work, mm-hmm. to earn money, to earn
yes. And the idea was to come here, you know, to work for a few years because he didn't want to be away from us too long.
Did he come here? And I've been chastised by immigrant organizations for saying illegally.
Exactly.
But I'm sorry to say that is exactly what that is. If you're here without a visa, if you're here without going through channels, you are here illegally. So did he come here illegally?
You may be illegally, but you're still, you know,
a human
undocumented
being. Yes, okay.
human being. But he did come here crossing the border, you know, let's put it that way. You know, he did come here crossing the border just like millions of people do.
But he didn't come here going through customs?
No, there was no way to do it. One, he didn't have the money to go to the embassy and say, I want a visa. Because you have to have money in order to get a visa.
How much
America.
Money?
Well, you have to show that you have properties. You have to show that you have a business. Or, you know, you have to show that you want to come to the U.S. to invest and to take, you know, and to create jobs and do the other things. For the average person in Central America, that's not possible.
You see, so in fact, the actual laws as written are not friendly to the economic powerhouse that America is. These people are not coming here to sit on the sidewalk and take benefits. They're coming here because they want to work and be successful.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and hear more of Elver Barrios' story, his family story, your father, your mother, because she also came here
exactly.
Before you did. And we'll hear more about the whole immigration situation that's unfolding on our southern border right now. Stay with us. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting the Bacon Brothers with special guest Cindy Alexander, sharply executed rock with a blue-collar, rootsy edge, August 4th in McGlowan Theater. Tickets at 704-372-1000. That's Kevin Bacon, by the way, and his brother. Most of us never used to give honeybees a second thought, but for several years they have been a topic of great concern because honeybee populations have been precipitously declining throughout the United States. That's not good because of the role that they play in pollinating our food. The short story is, no bees, we don't eat. So we're going to talk about bees, theories about what's happening, what they've discovered over the years with colony collapse, and the health of our local bees tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a growing number of American companies are reincorporating overseas for lower tax rates. Critics say the practice is a loophole that needs to be blocked. Debate over tax rules for U.S. companies.
Tune in the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about immigration, and we've talked about immigration on this program so many times with so many different people from who are here for different reasons. Some of them are lawyers. Some of them are from the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Some of them are political scientists. Some of them are actually immigrants. And everybody we've talked to, and I mean every single person, no matter what side of the political spectrum you come down on, says the system is broken. And our conversation thus far is a good indication that that is correct. Diane Stewart is with us. She's a South African Irish citizen, immigrant to this country, been in Charlotte before, had to leave, now is back, and waiting for word on permanent residency here, because if that doesn't come through, they have to leave again. Elver Barrios is with us, a Guatemalan whose father and mother preceded his arrival here. We'll talk about that. Jess George is executive director of the Latin American Coalition, an organization that Elver also works with. And Greg Weeks is professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. Your daughter, Sarah, Diane, is 24. She's on an F-1 foreign student visa, as you mentioned. She's in her second year at the, or she'll be going into her second year at the University of Cincinnati. She is too old to be on your application for permanent residency. So upon graduation, I'm told she will have to leave the United States. And your son, Michael, is about to start a second year at NC State. He was first in his class in engineering last year. Given our need for engineers in this country, is he likely to be allowed to stay when he graduates?
Well, we'll have to see whether the so-called STEM legislation holds. With the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the DACA law that the president passed 2 years ago, he did say that he was passing a STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math bill to encourage graduates at U.S. universities to stay here and, you know, participate in the economy and using their skills. We have an incredible shortage of STEM graduates in this country.
So here we have two young people who are virtually American. I mean, they lived all of their childhood lives here and are going to American universities, benefiting from our higher education system, who may be asked to leave once they're done. That's insane, isn't it? I mean, that just doesn't sound... That doesn't sound sane to me.
It doesn't sound sane. And Mike, this is interesting. You asked earlier in the show, why have we not been able to fix this? And Dr. Weeks said poor planning. And that's certainly true. And Diane mentions the fact that the history of immigration law, even though based upon family reunification, does not do us any favors in terms of making sure that we open up enough visas for people with a wide variety of skill sets from a wide variety of backgrounds that meet the economic and social needs of our country. But I think there's something we're missing. And that is probably captured in the intro that you had where we talked about, and I'm sure you were hyperbolizing or quoting the histrionics of some of the people in our country about these hordes of aliens crossing our border.
Yes.
These ideas about us versus them, these ideas that are really based in a lot of, frankly, racial prejudice and fear of people who we perceive to be different from us, have allowed folks to, at least at this very moment, politicize what is truly a humanitarian crisis on our border. And unless our country is really willing to wrestle with the fact that not only are we a nation of immigrants, but we are a nation and a community that deeply relies economically, socially, culturally upon the immigrant influx in our country, we will really be struggling with this for years to come.
Historically, haven't we always reacted to immigrants like this?
The answer is yes. So there have been periods of time when there have been reactions against Asians. There have been reactions against
the Irish.
The Irish.
The Italians.
I mean, so the answer is
Jews.
Yes. And often those are coming from people who originally were immigrants themselves. So, yes, those things do reoccur. But I would say, going along with what Jess says, is that this is also tapping into a deep polarization, particularly in U.S. Congress, in the country, but in the U.S. Congress, so that even in the past, let's say, 4, 5, 6 years, is that any effort to actually do anything about immigration in Congress gets tied up in other fights, Affordable Care Act and other things that are already pulling apart members of Congress, and then immigration then cannot be dealt with in a rational manner.
I've forgotten his name is Malley, and I think that's his name, and I've forgotten what state he's the governor of, but he's in a blue state that does not want to accept these children that are – we have all these kids in Arizona and in Texas who have come across the border without benefit of adult accompaniment, and they're in what essentially are kennels for kids, awaiting our government's decision about what to do with these kids. And some of the states that they're in have complained about they can't handle it. They don't have the resources to handle this. But some of the blue states who are saying, look, you red state people need to get with the program on immigration, don't want them either. They won't let them come there. And in this one situation, it's because there's going to be in the fall an election between the Democratic incumbent governor and a Republican challenger, and the Democratic governor does not want to be seen as soft on immigration.
You're dead on, Mike. I mean, absolutely. What's happening is not a red state and a blue state issue, because both Democrats and Republicans are equally horrible on this issue. What we have seen time and time again is this issue being fed to the media fires, used to fearmonger with some of the most hateful groups in our community. I mean, even our local media is quoting folks from well-known nativist groups as if they are a legitimate alternative to a rational conversation about the facts of immigration in this country. When we have over 70% of Americans supporting immigration reform, but our elected officials can't get their minds around creating policy, pragmatic bipartisan policy, the question really becomes, who benefits from a broken immigration system? And I think the sad answer is two people benefit, two large groups of people. Politicians who want to see this as political fodder for a coming election or coming campaign. And the other is me. It's you and me. It's those of us who live every single day benefiting from essential workers that pick our crops, that work in our meatpacking factories, that mow lawns, that build businesses, that build skyscrapers. We're sitting in beautiful downtown Charlotte, built by the hands of immigrant workers. This is the fact. You and I benefit every day
built by the hands of illegal immigrant workers?
Undocumented immigrant workers.
There we go with that word again.
Yeah, it's actually, words are so important. They're so important because certainly do people come here illegally? Yes. Because there is a law that is fundamentally broken that does not allow them to come here legally. But are they, as human beings, moms and dads, illegals? No,
yes,
they're people.
If we were successful, if we were able to absolutely shut the doors, no one gets in, where would we be today?
Let's actually reframe that question and say, let's take Charlotte, North Carolina, and let's make every undocumented person disappear. And I promise you, 50, 60, 70% of our businesses would shut down. You know
why?
Because we employ, our city employs so many undocumented workers.
So there's a great fear that people talk about when they talk about immigration, that these people are coming here, they're breaking the law to come here, they're not going through channels, they are undocumented, mm-hmm. and they're taking American jobs.
If we think about the jobs, right, like they think about the jobs that they do. Think about the type of jobs that, you know, we do on a regular basis, and who's willing to do those jobs? Who's willing to go at night, you know, middle of the night, 1 a.m., cleaning buildings around the town? That's what my mom has done for a long time. You know, when we think about who's picking up our crops during this heat summer, you know, we're hitting 95 degrees, 98 degrees and sometimes in the summer, and people are out there picking crops from like 8 a.m. or even 6 a.m. all the way to 8 p.m.
So your father came here in the 90s?
97.
What did he come here to do? What did he, in fact, do when he arrived?
Well, he came to do several jobs, trying to find, you know, what he could do. He was telling me that he used to paint buildings.
Okay.
You know, he used to get on top of the roofs and start painting buildings. He worked a little bit on landscaping. He worked in construction. He was doing all these kind of jobs that...
Was he paid with a paycheck?
he was paid with the paycheck.
So let's be clear about this, because this is another thing that people hold up and say, look at these people, they're getting benefits and they're not paying taxes. If you're paid with the paycheck, Your taxes are deducted.
Yes.
Your Social Security payment is deducted.
And
but you're undocumented. Will he ever get Social Security?
No, nothing. He was telling me that for about 8 years, he was paying 401k, and nobody explained to him what it was.
He was paying into a 401k?
Yes, he was paying into a 401k, and nobody told him what it was.
But is that his to keep?
Yes. No, he cannot get any of the money. He will never get anything of the money. Because he cannot get any benefits.
But that's a private investment.
But either way, you have to, when you... I'm not old enough to go get a 401k or get those benefits, but what I believe happens is you have to go fill out papers, put your Social Security down, and that's where the problem begins. You don't have a social to claim any of those benefits that you have paid for. You don't have any social to get all those benefits. People talk about, you know, welfare. People talk about all these things that we get. Mm-hmm. But you have to, in order to get those, you have to fill out paperwork. And if your Social Security is missing, they're going to ask you, where is it?
And
if you cannot provide it, then, you know, that's it.
And this takes us back to Jess's point, is that Americans like the system to stay in place because they're benefiting every day from it. We have 10 to 20 million illegal people paying into Social Security, paying into Medicaid, paying into all the benefits that American citizens get, and they will never get benefit of it ever unless they are one day made legal.
But if they get sick, they can go to the emergency room and they can use...
And then we get those large bills.
Then they
We've
have to pay. I have to pay a bill. When I... Absolutely. They do not get away. They will go and find the home that they're living on in if they own it, and they will take it from you.
Is that part of the problem, that certain significant, maybe big lobbies benefit, big business benefits from this, and therefore there is no impetus for the politicians to really move or take any major action on this because some of their big donors are benefiting from illegal immigration?
Well, I think that's a tough call because in some cases, banks, for example, would actually love people to have legal status, increase their salaries, and have more to put into the bank. So I think it's possible that some businesses who benefit from illegal labor and therefore can keep their prices down and their profits up, there may be pressure, but I don't think it's quite as simple as that because there'd be benefits on both sides.
But there are also stories of people, for instance, from Asia, India, places like that, who are coming here to get advanced degrees in computer science and engineering and medicine, and they too have to leave, even though we need those people, because our people, Native Americans, I don't mean Indians, I mean people who have been here and raised families who were born here, etc., for years. We're not going into those fields at that same rate, but we're making these folks leave even after they benefited from our education system. Why?
Well, there's been no connection between what are the labor needs of the country and how the immigration law is written. So there's just no, as I said, poor planning, is that there's no sense of what kinds of jobs will we need when.
And it isn't just these advanced degrees, as Elver brought up a minute ago. I mean, who picks the strawberries? Who picks the blueberries? Who does picks the cotton? Who does all the hard, hot, in the sun labor right. in this
and well,
country?
That's why those businesses, farms, say you cannot do mass deportations.
Because they have nobody to do it.
You can't, because our labor force will be gone and we will go bankrupt. And so you'll get stays on those because they need labor one way or another.
Why won't we do it?
Because it's really hard and unpleasant.
And I want to add is that I think that many Americans feel very entitled that they do not have to do those jobs anymore.
Mm. Anymore.
That's the real reason.
Anymore.
Right. Yeah. They need to go to college, they need to get a degree, and they do not need to be picking fruit.
So let me get back to Elber's story here, because your father came here in the hopes of what? Making enough money to send back to Guatemala?
Making enough money to send back to Guatemala, and also for, you know, to build a house so that we could live in a proper house, so that, you know, we could have enough money to go to school.
How did you live in Guatemala? What were the conditions?
So I lived in a small neighborhood, a colonia called San Jorge en Amatitlán in Guatemala City. And it was, dirt roads, so whenever it rained, we had big patches of, you know, water and mud everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Plumbing?
Yes, indoor plumbing. But, you know, at points we didn't
electricity?
Have... We had electricity, but we didn't have enough water.
Okay.
So because we lived on a hilltop, so the water we wouldn't get water for, like, months. So sometimes we were getting water for, like, 3 months. You know, sometimes we wouldn't have enough food for us to feed everybody. Sometimes we wouldn't have enough of everything.
So your father came here in order to send money back to the United States. Was he able to do that?
he was able to do that. And
support himself as well.
He was able to support himself. He was working, like I said, different jobs in order to do that.
How many different jobs did he work at any one given time? Did you know?
Two jobs at a given time, working overtime on both jobs.
And eventually your mother came here as well to join your father because they'd been separated for quite some time.
Yes.
And you stayed behind.
Yes, we stayed behind.
With whom?
With my two brothers and my aunt.
Okay.
So we stayed with my brothers.
And your mother, was she escorted over the border by your father, or did she make the trip alone?
She made the trip alone.
And once again, she did not go through customs. She did not come in with documentation.
Well, once again, it's the same reasoning behind it.
How dangerous was that for both your mother and your
father? My mom tells me stories that it took her over a month to get to the United States. They got lost so many times in the jungle, in the mountains, in Mexico. And, you know, trying to come just to the border was a struggle, and let alone walking through the desert for 3 days.
And then eventually you came.
Yes.
And once again, you did not come through.
Exactly.
Customs.
Because my parents needed to be in Guatemala.
Who escorted you from Guatemala to
Well,
the US?
You know, it had been 8 years since I hadn't seen my dad. And they made the logic decision that it wasn't safe for us over there anymore.
In Guatemala.
One time we were in school, my aunt got it called, and they said, you know, you want a car. You know, we're from the bank. Come and get it. Mm-hmm. She thought it was, you know, I won the lottery, basically. She ran to the bank. At that time, some men in yellow cars and really blacked into windows came over to the house and started looking for us everywhere. They almost broke into the house trying to look for us. They later went to the school and asked for us.
Who were these people?
These people... they were trying to kidnap us at that time.
To what end?
To what end? To ransom my parents, to get money from them, right? So the insecurity and the violence that was going on, you know, in the neighborhood, that we couldn't be out in the streets after 6 p.m. So all of that together, and, you know, and seeing little kids as young as 10 years old being recruited by gangs.
These kids in the southwest United States, in Arizona and Texas, who have come across as unaccompanied minors are from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Colombia, I believe.
Honduras.
And we're told they're coming because their parents think it's safer to send them through the jungles and the mountains and the deserts to get to the United States by themselves.
Yes.
Than it is for them to stay in their native countries because of gang violence.
It is.
But I think what
they might die on the way here, but they
might
will certainly die.
They will certainly die in their home countries.
Which begs the question: what in God's name is wrong with those countries?
Well, you know, if we, you know, I'm not a history major. I'm not. You know, I don't have a lot of history background, but I do understand and I do a lot of research that, you know, our countries have, you know, the struggle that we're going through right now has to do, if we go back to the 50s and 60s, of what the U.S. and these large corporations did to Central America, you know, when it came to fruit and vegetables. So looking into that, and I'm sure you can speak more to that, you know, I don't have the proper names or the proper language to explain that. But I do know that because of what happened at that time, our country was basically devastated economically. And because of that, you know, a lot of corruption came into play. And if you go to Guatemala today, you see police cars with like 10 police officers on it with assault rifles, you know, trying to contain crime. And they're not able to do it because the jails are so full that if you go into jail today, you know, 3 months later, you're let out because jail's too full.
And that crime is economically motivated? It's people trying to make money to live? Is that why the gangs are so appealing down there?
Well, there's no control. So, you know, people think that the easy way to make money is to, you know, take somebody else.
I'll try to get some historical and political perspective on this in a second, but we have to take a break, and we'll come back and get the rest of your story because you had to cross the mountains and the deserts to get to the United States as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Horak Tally, helping individuals and businesses find sharp solutions to their legal needs for more than 80 years. Details at HorakTally.com. Two U.S. appeals courts issue conflicting rulings on whether millions who buy health insurance on federally run health exchanges can get subsidies. This all happened yesterday. So what the decisions mean for consumers and the president's signature health care law will be the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes. 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation about immigration and the problems we've been facing for years in this country with regard to this, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, Facebook or Twitter will get you to us, and we are coming right back.
WFAE's Public Conversations get people talking.
Is there any way for a homeowner to know in advance what type of homeowners association they're dealing with? I hear that there are some that are overly zealous and maybe some that aren't.
If we've got greenway space, if we've got floodplain that is now being developed, what are we doing to preserve something?
Listen to WFAE for details on future community forums and come join the conversation.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about immigration and the situation we have in this country today with our broken immigration system. And we're talking to two people who are immigrants. Diane Stewart came here legally and is waiting for a word on a permanent residence. And she's come and gone and come back again by going through channels and still can't make hide nor hair of the system, and the system is not working for them. But Diane Stewart is with us. Elvin Barrios is here. He's from Guatemala. His parents came first. He and his siblings came later, undocumented, which yes. begs the question also, how can you sit here and be on the radio if you're undocumented? Don't you worry about somebody coming in here and hauling you away in the middle of the broadcast?
I have always worried about that.
Okay. Jess George is Executive Director of the Latin American Coalition, and Greg Weeks is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. Now, Elver alleged a minute ago that many of the problems faced in Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador, Central America, South America, with gang violence, with poverty, with people wanting to come here, having to come here and taking great personal risk to do so for their own personal survival and the betterment of their family, is in large part due to us, the United States, and some of the actions that we have taken historically through the years in these other nations. Can you speak to that?
Sure. I'm going to squeeze a semester into about a minute.
Good luck to you.
If you look at Guatemala, the U.S. invaded in 1954, overthrew a government, started a civil war that lasted until 1996. Mm. Then there was a civil war in El Salvador that got going around 1980. In both cases, the U.S. supported military dictatorships, which were fighting leftist rebels. These wars were extraordinarily destructive. And the countries are awash in weapons. So that sort of violence already pushed people out years ago, so that you saw a stream of people coming from Central America. Once the civil wars ended by the 1990s, then you have already economies that are pretty well crushed and very few opportunities. Right at the same time as we see this really tremendous appetite for drugs in the United States. And so the many people who might otherwise have been doing something productive get involved in the drug trade. It's very lucrative. Gangs then get involved. So you have MS-18, et cetera, who get involved. Then they're trying to suck children in to play some sort of role in the gang, and or, you know, even kidnappings. And so what you end up with is a situation where people want to leave.
If we played a role, and I'm not saying we didn't because you've laid out a pretty good case for it, and you haven't even talked about NAFTA, but if we played a role in breaking these countries, is it possible for us to play a role in fixing these countries? I know that the president is meeting later this week, I think on Friday, with the presidents of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras to talk about working together to stem the flow of these children across our border. But how? They have to get their gangs under control. They have to get violence under control. We broke it. Can we fix it if we wanted to?
It'll be very complicated and it'll take a long time, but the answer is you have to try. Otherwise, none of this is going to change. So that it has to be – anything we talk about, comprehensive immigration reform, if you ignore Mexico and Central America, then it's simply not going to work, because there has to be attention paid to economic development, to reduction of violence, and to controlling the gang problem. And we can't pretend that – it's not our problem.
Central America is not the only place in the world that we have supported dictatorships, despite.
But it's the closest one.
Yeah, they're our neighbors.
It's one of the closest ones. So.
Right.
And
it's,
I think the result of the children coming over is his example is a very good one. He came to be with his parents.
Right.
The vast majority of the children that are on our border right now are coming to be reunited with a parent or both parents. And I think people are missing that point. They're thinking that they're just coming here unaccompanied.
So in other words, one of their parents is already here. And so the other parent is getting them out of harm's way by sending them to the parent in the United States.
Absolutely.
Yes.
We've talked a lot on this show about the rule of law and who's breaking the law and who's not breaking the law. And we've also talked a lot about the culpability of American foreign policy in creating the instability in Central America. And I think there are a couple of really important points. Our law is not only fundamentally broken, it's one that we have not fixed for decades. We haven't changed our immigration policies enough to adjust for a changing economy. And so when we speak in terms of legality, who's illegal and who's legal, we are actually putting too fine a point on it. There isn't this black and white. And I think the Stewart story is a perfect one, where their situation goes from white to black to gray. And they're a family with resources, with connections, with extraordinary skills, with remarkable support network. And even the system failed them. But beyond
and if
that,
they can't make the system
can't
work
make it,
through channels, how can you expect somebody who's coming from poverty
mm-hmm. Exactly.
With no resources.
Exactly. And yet the immigrants have survived and flourished in spite of this heinous system. And I want to take this opportunity to thank all of the people out there listening to us right now that have helped immigrants. I call them our underground railroad. They have helped immigrants. They've supported them. They've loved them. They've taken care of them. They've fed them. They've housed them. They've encouraged them. They've given them work. And I think that is an extraordinary thing that Americans have done for immigrants.
And furthermore, when we're talking about these children at the border, when we're talking about who's legal and who's illegal, in the introduction to the show, Mike, you said that children were crossing the border illegally. There is nothing illegal about coming to this country and presenting yourself to USCIS as an immigrant and asking for asylum. And that is what these young people have done. They are doing nothing illegal.
And that gets lost in all of this because these people could be considered refugees.
Absolutely.
They're here for asylum, for their personal safety. How have we lost sight of that? There are so many people in this country who profess this country to be a Christian nation, which it is not, but they say that it is, and they fervently believe that it's founded on Christian, and it was founded on Christian principles. But it doesn't make us a Christian nation. That aside, how can they ignore children? Children.
Well, this is the, this
who come
is,
here for asylum.
This is the nub of the issue, is that we are so busy concerning ourselves with the legality and the breaking of our sacred laws that we have lost sight of the humanity that's at our doorstep. As MLK and St. Augustine and even the U.S. judges or the U.S. military tribunal at Nuremberg said, an unjust law is no law at all. And that sums up the entire situation. These are unjust laws that are not working for anybody, not for American citizens and not for the immigrants.
And these children, as I understand it, do not have to be – they have to go in front of a judge, an immigration judge, to have their situation determined. But they are not being supplied because the law does not make them supply these children who do not speak English an attorney. Mm-hmm. That's un-American, isn't it?
You wouldn't get an argument from me. But I just think that, again, it's the poor planning. It's that, okay, if you're going to provide – especially through the 2008 law that allows non-contiguous country migrants to go before a judge, a child, that there's a stipulation for that, but not a structure in place to make it work.
I was watching a news story about this the other day, and a phrase popped into my head from the McCarthy era: "Have we no shame?"
Well, I think if you protest children, then you know the answer.
Right.
Let me get back to your story, Elver, because your parents came here, and then did they come back to get you in Guatemala, or did they send you unescorted?
My mom and my dad were here, and they had heard so many stories of kids trying to cross the border alone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of their stories were, you know, my kid went missing and never heard from again.
Right.
Other stories were, you know, my kid was raped. And so they couldn't deal with that. But they knew that we weren't safe in Guatemala, so my mom decided to go back to Guatemala and get us and go through hell again crossing
talk
everything.
To me about the hill. What was the trip like?
So this was the trip. The trip was basically run, hide, jump on trains, walk through the desert.
And not passenger trains.
Not passenger trains. Talking about cargo trains. I remember this one night that, you know, they said, you know, the train's coming. It's going to stop for 1 minute. Get on it.
It's known as La Bestia.
It was pitch dark. It was pitch dark. So La Bestia, it's there. Everybody's running toward the train. It was about 50 of us. We jump in the train. You know, I was 14 years old. My younger brother was 11. And we are in a cargo train. All of a sudden, we're sitting on top of who knows what it was. You know, are we going to fall off it? You know, what's going to happen? And
so you're not in the car. You're on the car.
We're on the car, you know. And then, you know, then the train stops all of a sudden for who knows what reasons. And, you know, they say, everybody get off. Get off and trying to find, you know, a cart, you know, and a box, basically, so that we could get in and be more safe. And they finally found one that was empty. And everybody jumps on it. And, you know, the next morning we hop off the train before we get next to the next city. And, you know, we looked at each other and we were all gray. We looked at each other, you know, and we could only see our eyes and our teeth that were different color, but we're all covered in gray, gray dust. And we found out that it was a concrete box. They were carrying concrete from one city to another. So we were sitting there, you know, washing our faces by the river. And we stayed the whole day, all night, because we were afraid to go into the city. Because people could, you know, could tell our accent.
What country were you in?
We were in Mexico.
In Mexico.
Yeah, we only crossed one country.
How long did the trip take?
The first time we tried to come to the U.S., it was in November 2004. And we made it into the U.S. on January 2005.
That's a long trip.
It's a long trip.
And how do you eat? How do you?
Well, see, my mom.
Eat yourself.
This is one of the reasons my mom went back to. Because when you come into this country, you know, you're crossing so many countries, you know, without documents. Mm-hmm. You have to hide from everybody. You have to hide from everybody. So my mom knew that they don't let you eat because they don't want you to go outside and get food, and they don't feed you either. So my mom would go out.
2 month trip.
My mom would go out. My mom would literally risk herself, go out and get us food, because she knew we would be hungry. She knew that, you know, nobody would be there to take care of us. And these kids are crossing the border today.
By themselves.
By themselves.
So when you arrived in this country, how do you get around? I mean, how do you get from our southern border to Charlotte?
Well, you know, we crossed, you know, part of the desert, and we made it to Houston. And my dad came and get us because, you know, it had been 8 years.
This is not an uncommon story, I would take it. Mm-hmm. This is a story that could be repeated how many, 1,000 times, 10,000 times?
Absolutely. In Mecklenburg County alone, we have an estimated 50,000 undocumented people living right here, working right here, paying taxes, going to church, going to school, living their lives, but in terror of being stopped and torn away from their family members.
And here in Charlotte, it is said that our immigration population is outpacing the growth rate of both whites and blacks, leading to entire neighborhoods and schools where foreign-born people are in the majority. And there is another problem that rears its ugly head because people fear that, and it is also a drain on our economy.
It is not a drain on our economy.
On our resources, let's put it that way.
Well, we paid into the system. But we paid into the system. It's not we're draining anybody's resources if we already contributing to the system. My parents had been paying taxes, you know, 8 years back, and we had, you know, we came to school 8 years later. So they had been paying into a system that we had never gotten, you know, resources from. You know, we get here, we go to school, they're still paying their taxes. You know, I graduated from high school, I didn't have the opportunity to go to college right away because I didn't have the proper documentation, even though I had a 3.7 GPA, you know, great SAT scores.
So what happens to somebody like you have high grades, you're going to college, when you get out of college, you're still not going to be an American citizen, you're still going to be undocumented. What do you
for a lot of people that's the reality, right? That all of these young people who had come here before, and that's the reality that, you know, you graduate from high school, go into college, graduate from college, and then you're left with the degree and you end up working at a McDonald's or some fast food place or picking up crops or construction.
None of us win when that happens,
yes.
Alvar. None of us win when folks who are highly educated, highly skilled, are not able to be matched up with the job that they could be doing very well. And I also want to say that it's incredibly important. We talk about a drain on our resources. There's not an economist in this country that would say immigrants take American jobs. Not a single one. That has been completely debunked. And finally, Jim Johnson from the Kenan-Flagler School just released an updated study basically saying that immigrants, even undocumented immigrants in this state, are a net benefit to our state. There aren't the facts to back up the idea that undocumented immigrants are a drain on our resources.
Now, there are people who criticize the president for being weak on immigration, but I, after looking at some of the facts, it seems to me that nothing could be more false. He has been harder on immigration than previous presidents. He's deporting more people than anybody.
And he has earned that deporter-in-chief name by doing over a million deportations.
So what will it take? What is this a situation that in 5 years, 10 years, whoever's hosting this program will be sitting here talking about this same problem? Or is there any political will or ability to fix this for both people who want to come here through channels, for people who need to come here to make a living for their families,
to live,
and for people who are already here, what do we do with them? Is there any political will or ability to solve this problem?
Well, I think political will isn't the right way to think about it. There's going to be electoral reality, mm-hmm. and that is if you don't fix it as a party, you're going to disappear. Because so that there's going to simply be, and you already see it bit by bit in the Republican Party, is that if we don't address this, we are alienating such a large percentage of the population.
So when Rick Perry sends the National Guard to guard his southern border in Texas, that is in part political, but it's also because the federal government has abdicated and all the resource problems are falling on the states to handle this problem, and not just the southern border states, right?
Well, I mean, President Obama spent more on enforcement than any other president, so I think some of it is just a matter of logistics, is that you have to get people in the right place. But, you know.
All right, Greg Weeks, professor, we could talk about this for hours, and I said this before we started, we could do 2.5-3 hours on this, and we still wouldn't scratch the surface. Greg Weeks, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte, Jess George, executive director of the Latin American Coalition, Elver Barrios, Guatemalan and an immigrant to this country, and Diane Stewart from South Africa also.
I would just like to